in the prehistoric era, before glasses. I remember attending a church camp, and we also had rules. Fortunately, we weren't thrown into the swimming pool if we broke them, which is maybe why I was breaking it on this particular occasion. I remember sitting, shivering in our beds, and discussing after nights out, which should be quiet. And we were busy discussing a very philosophical topic. We were saying, you know, if we had been born into Muslim homes, we would be convinced that what we were taught by our Muslim parents was right. But we'd actually be wrong. And then the unspoken question came up, which, just too scared to actually say. Well, you know, we're born into Christian homes, how do we actually know that we are right? And that brings a bigger question. How do we know that anything is right? What is knowledge? How do we get knowledge? What is truth? Pilate asked this question of Jesus. And I don't know why he didn't stick around to hear the answer, because he was actually asking the only person who knew the answer to that question. But today we're going to try and unpack it a bit. So the purpose of today's talk is, how do we know? What are ways of knowledge? And if you want to follow and write some notes in appropriate places, let's first just recap a bit. Where are we? So we are trying to, now let's just keep on stopping working on it. So we're trying to determine which of these, well, three, but there are really only two serious theories of origins is more believable. One says that from goo, by way of the zoo, we came to you. You can ask the question, where did the goo come from? And the answer is that goo was made of chemicals. Where did those chemicals come from? Well, originally they were stardust. Where did those where does that stardust come from? Stars. Where did those stars come from? And our answer must be, eventually, nothing, which exploded into everything in the Big Bang. I'll get to questions later. I don't want to get bogged down by details yet. Let's just first get the big picture. Right, so then we have one option. Another option, we have an intelligent, creative being who creates certain kinds. I've only shown two kinds there, humankind and dog-wolf kind. And then those kinds vary, they reproduce after the kind, but with variation within the created kind. Okay, so how are we meant to try and make sense of, what is this thing called? It works now and then it starts working. Right, so in essence, one starts with nothing, the other starts with God. The nothing becomes everything in evolution, creation, or intelligent design. God creates everything using his intelligence. Everything then organizes itself by chance into the currently viewed apparent design and complexity, whereas God creates everything already in that complexity, and then it just diversifies from there. Another recap. We ended the discussion on Friday, by saying that, why should we worry about this? Who cares anyway? And one point was that the purpose of life and also the morality of life depends upon our view of origins. Actually, whether we can trust the Bible at all depends on our view of origins. Because the Bible is based on Genesis. If Genesis cannot be believed, then why should we believe anything else? And this has implications for our eternity. And we discussed that quite a bit, that if we don't believe there's a creator, why should we believe that there is any eternity? And therefore, what is the purpose of our life ends at the end of our life. Whereas if there is a creator, then he is a being higher in authority than ourselves, and he can make the rules, not us, and we'd better live by those rules, otherwise, after our death, we will have to suffer the consequences. So, let's now get on to the topic of epistemology. That's just a big word, you know, us speaking there in the dark that I told you about at the start. We were really debating epistemology, but we would, of course, not have known that. It certainly means how we know things, the study of knowledge. Now, I've divided this into three kinds of ways of knowing. I hope I've covered everything. One way in which we can know is belief in a higher authority. I think that the majority of our knowledge comes from this source. So, I've got a picture there of a Bible, but I'm not only meaning religious belief here. You are taught many things by your teachers, your parents, and you believe them. You have to accept some higher authority. You can't go and check everything out for yourself. Just imagine if you decided you're going to only accept things you've checked out for yourself. Let's just deal with physics. That means you can't accept Newton's laws. No. You've got to check this out for yourself. You've got to derive them yourself. You will have to have the brain of Newton and the lifespan of Newton to do that. And then you've only worked with a little bit of physics. Then you've got to now deal with Einstein's laws. Now you've got to have the brain of Einstein and the lifespan of Einstein, and then you haven't even dealt with the whole physics. I mean, this is totally inefficient to have to deal with everything yourself and actually observe everything yourself. So, that's why, in society, we learn a lot of stuff from one another. That's what we learn most of our knowledge. Now, I want to stress that with these different ways of knowing, you can't say this is wrong, that's right, this is the best. It depends on the context. It depends on what kind of knowledge has to be learned. And each has strengths and weaknesses. Now, I've put forward a strength of this kind of knowledge, namely it's efficient. There is the weakness, though, that it can very easily be wrong. There are lots of things which our parents and our teachers tell us which are wrong. And there are lots of superstitions which are passed down through the generations because the children believe the high authority of their parents or of their spiritual leaders or whatever it might be. There is a danger in this kind of knowledge. And so there needs to be some kind of check or verification of our validity. And so, you know, one needs to check is the authority. An authority in that area. Do they have some reason why they might mislead you? And other things like that. Now, we don't really have time here to speak much about the authority of the Bible and how to check it, but just briefly, I mean, if we look at the internal consistency of the Bible and the correspondence between prophecies in the Bible and what actually occurred, and records in the Bible and other historical sources, we can see that it is a book which is high on validity. I mean, we can trust it. It can be verified by other sources. So, if we say we believe the Bible, I mean, it's not like as if it's a total blind faith. It's a reasonable faith. We'll come back to this now, but let's go on to the next way of knowing, and that's philosophy. That is reasoning, or deduction, based on reasoning. And the Greeks loved this. They'd love to sit for hours and discuss and debate logic. Now, this has the strength that it's got a degree of transparency to it, because your peers can challenge you and say, no, but you're not logical, and point out one of those fallacies that I mentioned before. And in that way, you know, there's like a check of validity, or rather reliability. But there's a huge weakness in this, and that is something might be logical, but false. And this is very well seen in the history of science, because Aristotle was a Greek who logically reasoned out lots of stuff that was completely. And it was taught for 2,000 years because people just didn't question things then and didn't worry about actual data. And when people started thinking, well, we actually need to observe these things and see things for ourselves, not just believe what Aristotle taught, then they started to realize it was a load of nonsense. So then we got the age of science. And now science deals with deduction not based on reasoning, but on data. What's data? Things we can observe. What does observe mean? Things that we can get via our senses. Smell, taste, touch, hear, feel. Right, now, within science, there are two ways of knowing. One is doing an experiment. And this is quite a strong way of knowing. I think when people say I've proved something, maybe they are meaning they've done an experiment on it. Because this is repeatable. You can make a claim, and you can submit it to your peers for evaluation. If they smell a rat about it, they can go and repeat what you did and see whether it actually works. And if not, well, sorry. What happens in an experiment is that you have two or more treatments which you treat differently in a single respect. You control all other variables, and you see the outcome of that on another variable, and that establishes knowledge of cause-effect relationships. Problem is, you cannot do an experiment on everything. So although this fairly strong way of knowing is really, really nice, it's not applicable to a lot of the areas of life. And it's, unfortunately, not applicable to much in the topic of origins. And so, science has another way of knowing, and actually, I was thinking maybe it's not really fair to say science starts at the bottom, because this next way of knowing includes historical knowledge, but maybe I can, you know, pull it off and say historical knowledge is a kind of science. And this kind of knowing is working with data, but not the kind that you can do an experiment on. So historical knowledge would also fit here. We work with eyewitness reports from a variety of sources, and then we make sense of that. Or in the case of that paleontologist in the picture, we look at fossils, a variety of fossils, and we try and make sense of what actually that tells us about what happened in the past. Right, now, I had a debate recently with a graduate from UCT, from the engineering department. Now, he's from UCT, and an engineer, of course, he's very intellectual, very proud of that fact, and he said to me, you know, I'm not interested in any theory which has superstition as its base. Superstition equals belief. So that's why creation is a weak theory, because it relies on a belief. I only want to accept things which are scientific. Now, we must just understand this thing of science first, this realm of science and its limitations. Because what does science have to do with? Science has to do with the natural world. It assumes a natural order. It assumes that the laws of nature will always work. You can't do science without that. In other words, if you leave something, gravity will work on it. Whether you drop the thing on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, whether you do it middle of the night or early in the morning, in the swimming pool or if you like, whether you did on the pole or the equator, the laws of nature, they work. If they didn't work, then science, you know, just doesn't have a base to go on. It always assumes that the laws of nature work. But do the laws of nature always work? Can we say for certainty that we know the laws of nature always work? Belief can deal with many realms of knowledge. But it is maybe the only way of knowing about supernatural events or phenomena. What does supernatural mean? Breaking the natural laws of nature. And my claim is that every piece of knowledge has at its base a belief.
Well, why do I say that? Let's look back again at these two theories.
According to evolution, we start with nothing. It explodes into everything. Didn't we just defy the law of conservation of mass energy? I'll come to you just now. In other words, that does not work according to the laws of nature. To believe that, you've got to break the laws of nature. You are no longer doing science. And so that requires a belief in a higher authority. Okay? A higher authority who told you that that's how it happened. Who was not there themselves to observe it. And knew nobody was there. And a belief in a higher authority who was able to do that. So, what's the higher authority that was able to make nothing into everything? In my count, it seems like chance. Chance is that higher authority. Alright, then we get everything being organized over time into the complexity that we see today. And there as well, I would say that, you know, the higher authority which was able to do this amazing thing was chance as well. So, do you see that it's also a belief? Evolution is also a belief. I'm coming to you. Let's get through stuff first, otherwise I don't get through the basics, and then we get lost because we're speaking past one another. All right. Then, next piece of way of looking at things I want to cover is distinction between data and inference. To be able to evaluate which of these options is more reasonable. Maybe let me just go back here. So, you see the word proof is very strong, extremely strong. So, if we want to say, how can we prove whether evolution is right or creation is right? By proof I understand, no without any shadow of a doubt. Now, look, I can prove that this book is here because I can observe it. Alright? So I think that's something we can prove. There's very little we can actually prove, though. Only those things that we can observe directly. If we were to be limited by that, what we could have observed, we'd know very little. Alright. Maybe we'd say if we can do an experiment, we can prove it. Well, we cannot do an experiment on what happened when nothing became something. It's not possible. So then, in other words, we can never prove. We can also not prove, do an experiment on whether God created in 6 days or whether he did it all. You know, it's not possible. So maybe we have to accept that we can't prove anything about origins. But then, does that mean we can't know anything about it? For me, I think the question is more, which of these two theories is more reasonable a faith, a belief? And so we need to look at what we have, the footprints left behind by the event, and see what is more, what does it tell us, it could tell us a few things, depends how we look at it, which we want to get into, but what more reasonably, which explanation more reasonably fits with the data. Right, so now we need to speak about data and inference. Data means what you can actually observe. I've already said that through your senses. Now, in that picture, please imagine that it is actually a photograph rather than a clip art that I copied and pasted, because otherwise, of course, my point won't get across. The data you can see there, it would take me very long. It would be quite difficult to actually describe it because we don't deal with data. The human mind jumps to inferences almost straight away because data is too much information overload. Because for data, I need to say, okay, there's a brown, there are a lot of brown marks. Each one has a squiggle and then a half circle and it has four pointy. Instead, we just say, there's some footprints. Even when we say that, we are actually inferring. We're looking for a pattern in what we see, and we're making some sense of it. We say, okay, there's some small footprints that went to the center of the picture.
And then there were some large footprints, again, I'm actually using in this, but let's say that's data, to the center and then off. All right, now we normally won't, if we were to look at a situation like that, won't even describe what I've just said about the small footprints going to the center. We will rather explain what happened here.
Tell us
what you say.
I think that it looks like an animal and a person, some biped, walked in the same direction. They met, and it looks like there was some kind of struggle because of the erratic footprints. And the man is the only, or the biped is the only one who's walking away from the scene. Mm-hmm.
And so, what happened in the struggle?
It looks like he's probably carrying the animal,
ate him.
Okay, and you said he might have.
The man walked up the middle and met with that animal and he gave him a piggyback off the right.
That's what I'm saying. He might be carrying.
Alright, we might have eaten
him.
Okay, so do you see the point I'm making is that we don't really know. I mean, it might be none of that. They might have walked backwards. They might have been there at different times. It might have been the mother that played with the child and then maybe carried it away or left. So the point is that we can all observe the same data, but the story we make about it depends on our assumptions and a lot of other things that we bring to it and is questionable. Data, even data is questionable because look, someone could have actually gone and carved out those footprints rather than they really being footprints, so that maybe there was no animal there at all. So it can be forgery. Or someone might have drawn this picture from the photograph, maybe it wasn't a photograph, they just drew it, and they drew it inaccurately. Maybe someone took a photograph and went and photoshopped it. So even data is disputable. But let's maybe say scientists are, you know, going to be honest about the collection of data. Maybe then we won't dispute data. But inference, the story we get from the data, is always disputable, always. And so, we can view it like this, sort of like an allegory, or analogies. What is that saying?
God is now here.
You can see it like that, or else you can see it as God is nowhere. The exact same data. And it's often like that, and as we look tomorrow and the next day, at some actual data, and start getting into, you know, really the science of it, you will see that very, very often the exact same data can be viewed to show evidence of creation or evidence of evolution, depends how you look at it. And now question, I think, is not what does it prove, but which is more reasonable? So the question here, page 19, question 3, it says, scientist A reasons that a skull must be transitional between man and ape, based on the thickness of the eye ridges not being typical of either. So he finds a skull, he sees that the eye ridges are not typical of either. They're thicker than an average man, they're thinner than an average ape. And so scientist A says, aha, it must be an ape man, halfway between man and ape. Scientist B looks at that exact same skull and says, no, it's either a man or an ape, but not an average man nor an average ape. So they're looking at the same data and getting different inferences. We've got this problem, how is it possible that two people can look at the same stuff and come to a different answer and then they weren't yet seeing? How is that possible? In this group, you're the same. Or that's what they're saying.
B or A? What type of data do you use by each? A skull is the data. B, why do you think that it's likely that scientist A believes that the skull is transitional? Or possibly he believes in evolution, that's why he says that it's ape man. And then number two, is scientist B believes that the skull is not transitional, and he could believe in creation. It's like a reason. And she says, how's it possible?
Although he might also believe in evolution, it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily follow that. In other words, what you're saying is that these people are colored by what they believe actually happening. So then they interpret this in a certain way. In other words, what you're saying is that scientists can't be non-biased? Do people agree with that? Aren't scientists not objective? Can't they, you know, just take away their prior things and look at the stuff and
pull the conclusions away from the.
They're humans, like us.
Is there anything that you could tell us? Something else?
I think two people can look at one fish and see it differently.
Yes, why is that?
Is that because their minds will function differently?
Okay.
The thinking.
Why are they thinking differently? One is, as they've said, that they've got different belief systems which then make them see things in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It has to do with their worldview.
Do they want
all powerful God to which they and everyone else are accountable to, or do they want to be their own God?
So again, we get back to the why is this important that we discussed the other day. Yes.
It also depends on what evidence they're taking, what evidential context they're looking at. So if one person's neglecting the other scientist, say his evidential context, then it could mean that he doesn't know all of the argument. And the other side can say the same. It could mean that he doesn't understand all the argument.
So they might not be being dishonest. They might not be really... I mean, even I don't think that they purposely think I'm going to be dishonest. And see. They just can't see things otherwise. But it could also be that one has limited understanding about skulls, the range of thickness of the eyes for the different things. And so they might think that it falls within the range. Or they might know. I don't know. It depends what evidence they have at their disposal. One might have knowledge that the range for a man is over there and the skull falls within it. So it's a reasonable man, although it's not the average. And the other one might not know that. So, yes, I'm agreeing that sometimes it's not only that we colored and we biased and we so agree.
It's generally a lack of evidence.
Yeah, it might also be a lack of knowledge.
Yeah,
that we don't know fully what are the ranges. And so we form a faulty deduction based on that, even though we're trying our very best to be fair-minded. Yes.
So basically they kind of make mid-judgment on the limits of their own understanding.
Exactly. And man's understanding is limited. That's a very important thing to realize. The moment that a person claims otherwise, whoa, they are being so arrogant. I mean, this person who said to me, I only debate on things that, we can show scientifically. In other words, that man's mind is the highest thing there is. I said, wow, really? But a person can't even create the simplest thing. Never mind the complex universe that we live in. So, man's mind, you have to accept, is extremely limited. And so that causes us, our science often to be faulty, even when we're trying our best not to be biased, although we can't really ever not be biased, as quite a lot of you have been saying. Okay, yes.
The original things that you also learn in school could also have been incorrectly taught to you.
So you've got a lot of misconceptions that you come along with.
Many of them work. One of the possibility is that, suppose in this example, we found more of these exceptions. We might have stumbled on a third species, a third possibility.
That's right.
And I would also say, maybe to your friend, do you think there could possibly be a dimension or two or three or four beyond the three that we can sense and demonstrate scientifically? Do you think that's even a possibility? To see how far his mind might be able to stretch.
Indeed. Yes.
And accept the possibility.
And that takes me to another debate I had recently. I was at Kirstenbosch and we were looking at the stars and the Astronomical Society, and there was this professor, or whatever he was, speaking about these millions of years and everything, and we asked, how do you know? And we'll get into a bit of that, probably the day of tomorrow. But, we started debating, and he said, it is ridiculous to believe that God could have created the world, or that he did, because it is a fairy story, because, then you say, who created God? And the answer is, well, some people might say another God, and then you created that, you know, you've got just layers on top of one another. Or you might say, no, but God came from nowhere, or something like that. So I said to him, no, but we don't say anything of the sort. He's saying, God is eternal. He's always been there. Nobody was needed to create him. And so he said, oh, well, how can you think of that? In physical terms, you can't. But our minds are limited to that, so we can't think of that. Just because that's so doesn't mean to say that, you know, just because our minds are limited doesn't mean to say that it's not the truth.
And that's just another example of how little the mind seems to be able to stretch. It can hardly get itself around the concept that there might have been a being that always was. When we look at our own existence and those of our ancestors, and there was always somebody before, going all the way back to a point. We look at the animal world, it's the same way. There always has to be an adult to have a child, to have another child. In other words, the generational occurrence. And it stopped cold when it runs up against a being that doesn't have a parent. It doesn't have a father. It's an insult to the way we think. And the way we've been brought up.
But I also think plays a big role is that every person feeds himself with information. I mean, we've been fed with a lot of information this week. But still, the three dimensions, your spirit and your emotions and your intellect, also play a role with the absorption of all this information.
What you accept and what you reject.
Yeah, I mean, if I read the Bible and Jesus says something, my emotions confirm, you know, wants to believe it and wants to confirm it because it's loving it, because it's accepting. So I think it's a very intriguing thing that happens with a person that works with the information and then put his views on paper, you know, for the next user or whatever. It's being very intriguing at the end of the day. If you understand what I'm trying to say to you, I mean, it's all about the data that's been fed to you, to me. You know, and I mean, it's not your mind that just absorbs and works on the data. Your whole being with your spirit, whether it's generated or ungenerated.
And that's what people also say. I think it might have even been you. Scientists are also human. And so you can't, and they have these emotional parts as well.
Yeah.
So that's why, unfortunately, maybe this topic can tend not to be debated only intellectually. It gets emotional, and as soon as emotions get involved, then the brain kind of like switches off.
I'm almost convinced that Richard Dawkins comes from a very broken home, like Sigmund Freud, and I mean they're very limited. Their whole way of having an objective view about life is completely...
Apparently he was brought up in a Christian home and he had lots of questions which were never addressed. And, you know, the illustration I gave at the beginning where I was saying, you know, we were thinking, how do we know we are right? But too scared to actually say that. It is often like that we don't ask those hard questions because it's an emotional issue, and we know that the authorities will then, there's something wrong with you. But I believe that Christianity is strong enough to stand up to any question, and we need to ask those hard questions, and that is actually what gives us the solidity in our faith, so that, you know, we're not just a pushover. Yes.
I have 3 points. First one was your friend. He said he kept making sort of either or arguments and ignoring the engineer.
Okay.
And I don't think he's a very good example because he doesn't have a very thorough knowledge of the scientific method because he's ignoring the third variable problem. If you can't prove either way or if you can't link causation and you can only link correlation, then there's always the third variable problem. There's always the maybe there is something else creating both of these circumstances that we don't understand. What was I saying?
Come back.
Forget it.
So, I just think it's very unfair. You know, they're playing a very unfair game to us in the sense that, you know, when they make these claims, we react emotionally.
Yes.
But when they got to these claims, their emotions played a role. Do you understand?
Yes.
Their spirit, their ungenerated spirit, their emotions, of whatever it was, played a role for them to come to that conclusion. And here we come and we react emotionally, and I say, but why are you so emotional about
that? But I do think that that is a reason why we have to have knowledge. And tomorrow and the next day we're going to look at some knowledge. Because if we can only answer emotionally, then that we are not debating validly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like that first example I gave on Saturday, where the only thing I could say was, I'm not going to tell you because you wouldn't believe me. I mean, that was an argument fallacy of ad hominem, I was name calling, really. But it was also an emotional response because it was just protecting myself. That's all I could draw on.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I did nothing to the cause of creation there, but rather, I mean, actually I did a lot of harm.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can only answer emotionally, you know, I've seen some people who just say it's a fairy tale and it's silly and hard and make jokes about evolution. And I'm kind of like, but you can't do it that way. You've got to approach it intellectually, because we have the intellectually stronger stance, as I hope I'm going to show tomorrow and the next day. So I know that I'm not yet convinced. That's fine. We'll talk about something for some more time. But, you know, I think we do need some facts, and that's what we're going to get into tomorrow and the next day, to get a bit more meat.